and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you and 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Should 5% appear too small? Be thankful I don't take it all. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. If you drive a car, I'll tax the street. If you try to sit, I'll tax your seat. If you get too cold, I'll tax the heat. If you take a walk, I'll tax your feet. Tax man, 'cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Don't ask me what I want it for, if you don't want to pay some more, 'cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Now my advice for those who die, declare the pennies on your eyes, 'cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. And you're working for no one but me. You're working for no one but me. You're working for no one but me. Tax man! Well, I can't imagine what made me think of that song. Oh, wait. I did spend several hours at the library yesterday getting some help filling out my income tax. I have to file because I got Obamacare last year. Starting to wonder if it was worth it. Can you believe I actually owe money? I'm sitting here living on Social Security with just a few bucks coming in from my internet or publishing work, and they say I owe money, and it's hundreds, not tens of dollars. That's pretty messed up. I suppose I have to pay it. You know, I talk a lot, I preach pretty much about tax resistance, about not giving in to war taxes, and now here I am, I'm actually in a position where I need to pay them, and I'm probably going to end up doing it. It's times like this, I really admire the people who stand up and go to jail, if that's what it takes. Megan Rice and the rest of the Plowshares movement, for example. The Berrigans. Arnold Abbott, Mark Sims, and the rest of the activists who fed the homeless despite the draconian anti-homeless laws passed down here in Fort Lauderdale. And all the others who put their freedom or their lives out there in harm's way because they believe in something. I honor all of you. And I'd like to single out one more, my very own co-host, Mike Palachek. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and I'm proud to introduce Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Chuck, kindly welcome back special guests Susan Lindauer, Richard Flamer, Phil Ferruggio, and Jim Fetzer. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Chiapas, Madison, Port Orange, Tacoma Park, and wherever you are. And actually, Richard Flamer is not in Chiapas tonight. He'll be speaking to us from the Des Moines Catholic Worker. A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America. It's a book. The culmination of all of this is Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett and the False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio every Thursday. They are the evolved media. We know that today's newspapers, radio, TV are garbage, as well as the current version of what passes for alternative media, The Nation, The Progressive, NPR, alternate Rachel Maddow, Goodman, Jon Stewart, if not garbage, at least suspicious, very suspicious. But what we want to do right here is to say something in this mini-series, hear about the history of alternative press, the beginnings that have evolved into Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett and perhaps Chuck and I. We hope to be in that group. From the book, the conspirators of the underground press claim a distinguished heritage. Thomas Paine was only one of many revolutionary ancestors in the late 18th century. In the 1760s and 1770s, Sam and John Adams, among others, divided their time between the libations of the Green Dragon Tavern and the office of a renegade weekly newspaper called the Boston Gazette. The Gazette, which published from 1719 to 1798, campaigned effectively for repeal of portions of the hated Stamp Act. Legend has it that the perpetrators of the Boston Tea Party donned their Indian costumes in the Gazette office. A trumpet to arms, alternative media in America, continuing next week. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. All we need is a 10 and a fiver, car and keys and a sober driver. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. We now join in progress another episode of the Wisconsin Daytime Drama Series sponsored by the Wisconsin Arts Council, hoping you will contribute to their most recent fundraising attempt to get Blaze Orange and Camel the recognition they deserve on the state flag. And now we bring you straight out of Kenosha. We find Curly talking to Hal the bartender during happy hour at American Legion Post 99. Hal is just now refilling the green and gold plastic peanut bowl.
Another PBR, Hal.
You got it, Curly.
How much freedom can one man stand? Freedom comes in many forms in America. New forms constantly being created. The latest has been freedom from basic financial security. The weakened economy has given corporatists an excuse to, as they say, let workers go. Which sounds as if companies are granting employees some sort of freedom. Go on, George. 20 years on the job is long enough. So get out of here. Have yourself a ball. By that measure, there have never been more free people. Now, benevolently relieved of their job responsibilities, millions are free to do almost anything they choose. Go fishing. Take up the banjo. Depending on how you look at it, the American people are either freer or simply getting better at what we've always represented in the world. A bunch of powerless and unquestioning mental midgets. My money's on the latter. Midgets can seldom see over the fence. Consequently, we see the world from inside the fence and on such small terms as paychecks and families and no farther. We cannot identify even with a national level struggle for the same things we want, much less the global one for human dignity and fairness in labor. Exclusive devotion to family is the chief virtue here, along with a maniacal devotion to the closest football franchise. Moreover, it's the only responsibility a man has, the sign of a good man, a real man, accepting personal responsibility for the credit card bills. That one's personal responsibility might also extend to the larger world. It's incomprehensible.
Uh-huh.
And you know what else, Hal, me boy?
What's that, Curly?
Well, meanwhile, union workers at downsized Sony and 3M plants in France hold CEOs hostage and threaten to burn down the factories. That's the downside of metal midgetism. Every fence is a tall fence. Knowing stuff is too much work. Then, too. The fence was made quite a bit taller by the American media blackout of the French union action. I mean, hell, those unions are communist. My friends abroad tell me it's pitiful to watch such unquestioning bovine Americans. I tell them it isn't much fun to watch from the inside either. But as American culture and society became more complex with more moving parts, it became more distracting. decades ago, we reached the point where the level of distraction was so high that few were capable of navigating with enough individual consciousness intact to reflect upon, much less question, the nature of our national environment. Like the rest of the planet, Americans mostly respond to the world as it is presented to them each day. But the world, as it is understood by Americans, now comes through many layers of distorted filters, most of them purposefully distorted, for economic financial gain by one overarching entity or another. So much so as to be atomized, kaleidoscopically diffracted. One cannot identify even the simplest object through a kaleidoscope. Bedazzled, disoriented, and detached from reality, we are rendered effectively blind, thus easily directed and managed. So we listen to the few loud voices, to the many, and disregard any dissent as background noise. In fact, as material, social, and political complexities increase beyond our available time and ability to think about or study and comprehend the larger order of things, we came to desire ever-increasing control. The emerging authoritarian one voice to the many neatly solved this problem by answering the important question of our time. Is anybody in charge here, for Christ's sake? Finding mess piles in my yard, homeless people coming to my door asking for food or work. A freaking street gang just rented the house next door, and I can't get a customer service operator who speaks English. Who's in charge here? The one voice of government answers, I am. Good, Ben. Do what you got to do. Make my decision for me, because I haven't the slightest friggin' idea what's going on. We find ourselves awash in new freedom. There are those aforementioned 17 million folks freed from work, and at least 45 million people are free from the onus of health care and all those time-consuming trips to the doctor or dentist. More than 60 million folks are freed from the rigors of financial planning because they now have zero net worth thanks to the mortgage bust. More than a million are free from even having to decide when to eat, shower, take a crap, or sleep because they're in the joint, doing time, mostly, for parole violations of some previous offense. I've been around 62 years, and I'm here to tell you I've never seen such a deluge of freedom in my entire life. That's a foot-stomping truth, and I don't doubt for 1 minute there aren't more freedoms coming down the pike. I can feel them in these old bones. Just might need a bump of old granddad to brace myself for the next one. Lordy, lordy. I just might.
You got it. Coming right up, Curly. Join us next week for another Wisconsin Daytime Drama, straight out of Kenosha, sponsored by Cheesehead Earbuds, Beverly's Big Bratwurst, and Lake Wasota Mulch Beer. Our first guest of the night is Richard Flamer. Richard Flamer is with his wife. He is runs and lives at the Chiapas Catholic Worker in Chiapas, Mexico, and they are associated with the Des Moines Catholic Worker. And at this present time, Richard is up here in the States, and he is going to be speaking to us from the Des Moines Catholic Worker, and Chuck will be calling him right about now. Richard is he's a former Vietnam veteran. He's a construction guru. He can do everything in the construction field. He was a rare book dealer. He was once a assistant warden of a prison somewhere.
Good evening, Chuck.
Well, hello, Richard, and welcome to the show.
unlike my normal shows, I'm calling this time from Des Moines, Iowa, where I arrived last week, and for the last 4 days, it's been what one would call a culture shock. You'd think after 25 years of traveling back and forth, I'd be used to it, but somehow it affects me differently each time I come. This time I'm staying at a Catholic worker house in Des Moines, where I'm sort of catching up with old friends, although the Catholic worker life is so chaotic that people come and go with some regularity. And many, there are many new people here, and some of the older folks have gone on. Others are semi-retired. but I'm finding there's lots of changes here, and most of them good. The other day I watched as they took in food from Trader Joe's. Apparently they get the food, which is starting to go out of date. It's not quite out of date, but will be in a week or two. So the food comes in and gets dispensed from the front room of the Catholic worker house. And seeing the quantity of food that gets thrown out by the grocery store, it's just staggering to me. And when the food came in last week, or the other day, I thought I was going to cry. I kept thinking, all those people that I know in Chiapas who could use this food, and they don't have a chance, not any kind of opportunity to get things like brie cheese and to get these rye breads that are really thick, and meat like salmon, fresh salmon, and it's just, and pastries, and most of it organic. And I think, well, I guess that's something to shoot for down there, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. When I first got here, I made my appointments and went over to the Veterans Hospital. I have a small disability from the VA, which provides half our income down there. we live on $500 from the VA and $422 from Social Security for a grand total of $922 a month. It's not a lot of money, but it seems to work out for most of us, for us, my wife and I, although we're relatively wealthy compared to our neighbors. They, in Mexico, they just passed a new minimum wage, and the minimum wage was raised to 70 pesos a day. And to give you an indication, currently the peso is being exchanged 15 to the dollar, so it's not quite $6 a day. And in many cases, things like meat are more expensive down there than they are up here. Many of the foodstuffs are the same or a little higher than up here. So it sort of limits most families down there to meat once a week, and beans and rice and tortillas, which isn't the healthiest of diets, but they seem to get by. I managed to line up some work with some friends here in Des Moines. So I've been installing fans and cleaning up yards and doing a bunch of work with a friend of mine who has a computer service. And I basically cleaned up all the electrical lines in his old house. I'm continuing to work on that and will for the next week or so. But it provides me with a pretty good income, and I'll probably have this job for two more weeks, which would give me a place to start from for the money. Then I'll head on over to Omaha, where I have a couple of jobs lined up there as well, some electrical jobs. So I should manage to get two or three weeks of work in over there as well. And I've been making appointments with the VA, and turns out because of my diabetes, they're going to give me a pair of shoes. And I said, well, we're up in the mountains and the rainforest, and shoes don't do me any good. I can't wear them there. I need boots. So they're going to give me a pair of new boots. And I went over in making arrangements for a donation of tools for a little town where we've been working in Guatemala, a place called Yalambahosh. And I have an appointment scheduled with a man who owns this woodworking store here in Des Moines, big store. I have a list of tools that came out of his catalog, so I know he has them all. And it comes to about $12,000 in tools. And I'm going to go hit him up this week. Although, actually, the way it's looking, my date with him will be postponed until Tuesday. And somewhere along the way, I need to find a truck which I can drive down with all the tools in it. And I'll be talking with friends and possibly some churches to see if they have anything or could be able to help buy one. Then I've been scouting books. I read constantly down there. Usually take 3 or 4 cartons of books with me when I go. Anywhere from 50 to 100 books. In part because there's only one other book. There's one bookstore in San Cristobal de las Casas that it carries American or books in English, which are secondhand. And unfortunately, Amazon and the other internet companies don't ship to Mexico. So I'm always hurting for books in English. I do read in Spanish as well, but usually only about a book a month. It's difficult for me to read in Spanish, the kinds of things I want to read anyway. So I've been scouting the places where I know I can get paperbacks for free, including, of course, the Catholic Worker, where I picked up a couple of titles this last week. And then at the VA, people donate their paperbacks. And so you go to the waiting rooms for urology or the emergency room, and there's always racks and racks of paperbacks. So I figure nobody's going to miss the books. And then I go through and pull 3 or 4 titles and walk into the VA with my backpack empty and walk out with it full. So I have another 25, 30 books from the VA. And then as soon as I get some money in, I'll be ordering some and continue packing them up and trying to get ready to get back. It's a really strange feeling. I've only been here roughly 9 days, and I'm already trying to plan on going back. I just don't like it up here very much. And I miss my friends. I miss talking to in English. But then on the other hand, I get so frustrated with the people here and such petty concerns. And we have people starving to death, and the children are so badly malnourished in the little school in front of us. And then I hear people come into the Catholic Worker and complain because they're not serving chicken tonight, or there's a hot meal, but it's not necessarily what they want. And I understand that poverty up here in the U.S. is different than poverty in Mexico, but I understand that intellectually. And when you've lived with people who have 2 or 3 children and they're all malnourished and growing, but this is the time they should be growing, but they're not growing because they don't have the right meals. They don't have enough to eat. It's a sad, sad occasion. So I guess I need to quit complaining and get back to work. So I can get back down there and work somewhere where I do feel appreciated, and the life is designed, as Peter Morin said, it's a place for me to do good and to be good. Mm. And I think I need to get back down there. So tell me what's going on. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. I think Mike is too. But Richard, I just want to say that it's really amazing to hear your insights as you move back and forth between these vastly disparate cultures. You're the only person that I know. I'm sure there are others, but you're the only one that I know who does this on a regular basis, goes back, and it's such a significant difference from one to the other. I really appreciate your sharing your impressions.
Well, you're welcome. I don't think there are a lot of people going back and forth, incidentally. I think I have some friends who are Vietnam vets who live down in Mexico. Incidentally, the figures from the U.S. Embassy indicate that there are over 7,000 veterans from the Vietnam era living in Mexico. And most of the people that I know who are Vietnam vets down there don't return. They don't come back to the U.S. And which doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. But,
I'm one of the few that does come and go. And to be real frank, I'm not real crazy about it.
Right. I understand.
But we have things to do. And the people up here in the U.S., I find so many people are generous. This man I'm working for is paying me $30 an hour to do electrical work. And that money's going to go back down and we're going to do wonderful things with it. And my wife will be joining me on the 15th of May to be flying up and practicing her English at the Catholic Worker.
Oh, that sounds good. That's good.
Yeah.
Richard, we're almost out of time, but if any of our listeners, you never know, maybe somebody has a truck or something. If somebody needs to get in touch with you, how can they do that quickly?
The easiest way is to write or call Holy Family Catholic Church, 1715 Izzard Street, Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next month.
Okay, bye.
The American Academy of Letters and Colors, Whole Numbers, Matching Things, Consonants, Fractions, Rhyming Words, Education, and High Honors has announced that people should stop reading newspapers, magazines, and immediately stop watching TV news. It's a shame that you even started, to tell you the truth, says the press release document. We mean, what good is all that other stuff if you don't even know this, continues the official press release document thing. The Academy is offering a National Emergency Homeland Security GED in Liberal Arts and Education and History and Meaning and stuff like that for watching the following documentaries according to the press release document right here. Recommended, Wellstone, They Killed Him by Snowshoe Films. A Noble Lie, RFK Must Die. Jim Fetzer, What Happened to JFK and Why It Matters Today. Kevin Barrett on the 9/11/2001 attack. The assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King with William Pepper. We need to talk about Sandy Hook. The Boston bombing hoax, Deep Inside the Rabbit Hole. Charlie Sheen talks about the truth about 9/11. A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon by Bart Sobrell. The Apollo astronaut press conference. to repeat, because you are Americans, after all, just saying, the American Academy of Letters and Colors, whole numbers, matching things, consonants, fractions, rhyming words, education, and high honors has announced that people should stop reading newspapers, magazines, and immediately stop watching TV news. It's a shame that you even started, to tell you the truth, says the press release document thing. We mean, what good is all that other stuff if you don't even know this? Continues the official press release document. The Academy is offering an emergency Homeland Security, GED, and liberal arts, and education, and history, and meaning, and things like that for watching the following documentaries, according to the press release document. Recommended, Wellstone, They Killed Him, by Snowshoe Films. A Noble Lie, Kill the Messenger, RFK Must Die, Jim Fesser, What Happened to JFK and Why It Matters Today, Kevin Barrett on the 9/11/2001 attack, The Assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King with William Pepper. We Need to Talk About Sandy Hook, The Boston Bombing Hoax, Deep Inside the Rabbit Hole, Charlie Sheen Talks About the Truth About 9/11, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon by Bart Sabrell, The Apollo Astronaut Press Conference. Also, the Academy adds that there are more videos you can watch for extra credit over the summer if you contact their office before they leave for Cancun for summer break. And now please join us as we join In Progress, a National Press Club Hall of Fame presentation with our guests, Philip Berrigan, Thomas Merton, Marilyn Buck, Daniel Berrigan, George Jackson, and Hunter S. Thompson. First to make his way to the podium, Philip Berrigan.
In Catholic Church and parochial schools, I had learned that God created man in his own image and that all human beings carry the divine within us. In order to kill other men and women, I needed to make them less than human. I needed to become anesthetized. More, I had to believe that I would never become one of those mutilated things. Unlike them, God was on my side. Unlike them, I was blessed, surrounded with the aura of pure goodness. We'd gone overseas with 105 howitzers, but someone got the bright idea that because of our marksmanship, we should be outfitted with new guns. So they got us 8-inch weapons, which were actually naval guns fitted for field artillery use. And our battalion went into Brittany armed with these guns, which could reach targets 20 miles away. We fired on Germans hunkered down in submarine pens in Brest until the pockets of Nazi soldiers were either killed or the stragglers crawled out and surrendered. The Germans were heavily fortified, and they were resisting even though the sub pens were no longer operating. They just wanted to hold on, and we kept firing and firing. I, too, was sane when I marched through Georgia on my way to liberate Europe instead of fighting to free those sharecroppers from racist terror and oppression. Sane when I slept in my warm room while black soldiers huddled in the snow. When I calibrated those long-range guns, determined to kill men I had never met, never talked to, would never see until their bodies were scattered about the bunkers. When I toured those German towns and cities, my nostrils contracting from the stench of death, my heart unmoved by all that misery. Thomas Merton concluded that if sane men could orchestrate the Holocaust, if sane men could build nuclear weapons, and if sane men could prepare to annihilate not only their enemies but the world community, then the sanity of modern man is about as useful to him as the huge bulk and muscles of the dinosaur. Yesterday, after my return from the killing fields, I looked into the mirror of my own violence. What I saw there forced me to rethink and redefine the meaning of sanity. I realized that while I considered Adolf Eichmann a war criminal and despised him for participating in the Holocaust, we actually had a few things in common. Like him, I'd only been following orders. Like him, I was sane enough to do my duty and to do it well. Like him, I believe that wars are fought for noble reasons. We were both true believers, one a mass murderer, the other a killer on a smaller scale. When I first started to think about these things, my heart turned to stone. My head swam with clouds of confusion. Examining my own responsibility for the death of 70 million people in World War II, it occurred to me that the United States government and I as a soldier had adopted some of the worst aspects of Nazism. The Luftwaffe bombed London, so we had the right to firebomb Dresden. The Germans murdered civilians en masse, so we were entitled to slaughter their women and children. Our actions were not crimes against humanity. They were retaliating for their crimes. Their actions were barbaric. Our reactions were just. I vacillated between feeling betrayed and the sense that I was betraying some sacred trust, some sacrosanct ideal. I began to see that there is no separation of church and state in America. There's merely a collective articulation of power by individuals and groups who claim to be critical thinkers. As a priest, I stood square in the middle of the power pyramid, interpreting positions of power to my parishioners and students. Though I didn't realize it at the time, my job was to interpret the capitalist, expansionist, war-driven paradigm of America's military-industrial complex, making it appear rational when, in fact, it is destructively irrational. I became a priest, someone my parishioners could depend on and trust, a representative of the Roman Catholic Church. But what really did I know? I'd spent 15 months in Europe participating in the horrors of modern warfare and knew nothing about war. I was determined to help men and women live together in holy matrimony and knew nothing about marriage. I wanted to help people be good citizens, even though I didn't know how our government functions. I had committed my life to helping others, yet I didn't have the slightest idea why millions of Americans live in poverty. I was going to be a friend of working men and women without understanding the labor movement's struggle for safe working conditions and fair pay. When I studied in this seminary, priests were mass-produced to be silent, to be conformists, and to be patrons of the government. We weren't allowed to read the whole range of political thought and its applicability to the marketplace. Like most of our counterparts in colleges, universities, public schools, and seminaries, we were taught to believe in the capitalist system, never questioning how a system that poisons the environment imprisons and executes the poor and thrives on war could be compatible with the teachings of Christ. Thoughtful religious people are beginning to view the church as increasingly irrelevant. They're seeing the church as an institution rather than a community of belief. The church is a major worldwide institution, and it is even more conservative, perhaps, than our government. Not conservative in the sense of conserving the gospel, but in maintaining useless rituals and policies that are designed to protect and perpetuate the institution. Pope John Paul will never allow priests and nuns to marry or permit women to become priests. I doubt whether his successor will change that. The institution is dominated by men who apparently are unwilling or unable to acknowledge our world's desperate environmental, economic, and spiritual crisis.
Philip Berrigan continues.
Dan and I walked around the prison's compound trying to reflect on what the Harrisburg indictment really meant. Would we spend more years, perhaps even the rest of our lives, in prison? It was a distinct possibility. The charges were so absurd and the government so deadly serious. Would I ever see Elizabeth McAllister again outside Danbury's walls? Would my elderly parents die without my giving them one last hug? I was beginning to understand how ruthless and cruel our government can be. Imperial states are about ripping people apart, chewing them to pieces. That's what the government was doing in Southeast Asia, and that's what it was doing at home. I made peace with myself. If I had to spend the rest of my life behind bars, so be it. I was prepared for the worst, that I wasn't going to make any deals with anyone except my God and my conscience.
Join us next week for the National Press Club Hall of Fame Hour with our guests, George Jackson, Marilyn Buck, Thomas Merton, Daniel Berrigan, and Hunter S. Thompson. Our next guest of the evening is Jim Fetzer, a former Marine Corps officer. Jim Fetzer has published widely on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and evolution of mentality. McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He was also conducted extensive research into the assassination of JFK, the events of 9/11, and the plane crash that killed Senator Paul Wellstone. The founder of
Mike and Chuck, it's a real pleasure to be back with you again, and thanks for the special invitation for last week about the Boston bombing, which is appalling, and of course where we now have the absurd situation where a young man, Zohar Zarnov, who had nothing to do with the Boston bombing, has been found guilty of 30 different offenses for what was a drill where no one died, where all the authorities are aware, where the police on bullhorns were calling out, this is a drill, this is a drill, where the Boston Globe was tweeting that there would be a controlled explosion during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities, where we have a perfunctory explosion that wasn't capable of killing anyone, and where you have alleged victims lying around, but there is no blood, where we have a Hollywood producer-director who's observed that this was hyper-realistic filming using actors, one of whom, Carlos Arredondo, he had cast in one of his own films. And let me just mention, if you want to see, you know, a variety of videos about the Boston bombing that reinforce everything I have been telling you, where you can read my five most recent articles on Veterans Today at veteranstoday.com/author/Fetzer. Go to deepinsidetherabbithole.com/Boston_videos, and you'll find a half a dozen or more. But the one in particular I want to recommend is Carlos Arredondo, Boston Hero or New World Order Fraud. Just watch that. It runs not quite an hour. In fact, I'm going to use it on my own show tomorrow, I believe. That's something I'm planning to do. So you could also watch it then by going to the, you know, watching the real deal online. But today I want to talk about the fact that they're using all these false flag attacks because the United States has no domestic terrorism problem. Many of you have probably heard me report more than once that the Senate Committee on Homeland Security had released a report on 3 October 2012, explaining that based upon its review of 680 fusion center reports for fusion centers merged federal, state, and local anti-terrorist activity, between 2009 and 2010, all over the country, they'd found not a single instance, not one instance, zip, nada, zero, zilch, of domestic terrorist activity, nor any case in which a fusion center had thwarted a domestic terrorist event. So they have to manufacture these. And interestingly, Senator Tim Colburn has just Tom Colburn, ranking member of that same Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, has just released a review of the Department of Homeland Security's missions and performance dated January 2015. Track this down. And you'll find he faults them on all five of their major mission assignments, which include preventing terrorism and improving security, securing and managing our borders, enforcing and administering our immigration laws, safeguarding and securing cyberspace, strengthening national preparedness and resilience. In fact, the Homeland Security, which was a creation of the Patriot Act, has been a catastrophe. It was modeled after the East German Stasi, the most efficient secret service, secret police entity ever created by the mind of man. And they brought it here, right to the United States, to run the United States from the inside by consolidating 35 previously independent agencies. And I have no doubt that it's acting much more in the interests of Israel than it is in the interests of the United States. It's fairly appalling. Now, just to appreciate the depth and breadth of false flag attacks, I want to make you aware of an article on George Washington's blog. GeorgeWashingtonsBlog.com admitted false flag attacks. The number he has here are 53. And as he points out, this is not theory, these are facts. Let me mention a history of these so you begin to get the idea, because every American, in order to be informed and to understand what your own government is doing to you in perpetrating these phony attacks, such as Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing, they're learning from a vast history of false flag attacks. Let me go through a sampler of these. Japanese troops set off a small explosion on a train track in 1931 to blame it on China to justify the invasion of Manchuria. A major with the Nazi SS admitted during the Nuremberg trials that they had faked an attack on Germany by Poles in order to justify the invasion of Poland. Nazi General Fritz Halder also testified that Hermann Göring admitted to setting fire to the German Parliament building in 1933, falsely blaming the communists for the arson. That's known as the Reichstag fire, one of the most famous celebrated false flags in history. Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev admitted that the Soviet Union Red Army shelled the Russian village of Manila in 1939 and blamed the attack on Finland in order to go to war against Finland. The Russian parliament, the current Russian president Putin and former Soviet leader Gorbachev all admit that Joseph Stalin ordered his secret police to execute 22,000 Polish army officers and civilians in 1940, and to falsely blame it on the Nazis. The British government admits that between 46 and 48, it bombed five ships carrying Jews attempting to flee the Holocaust to seek safety in Palestine, set up a fake group called Defenders of Arab Palestine, then had the pseudo group falsely claim responsibility for the bombings. Israel admits that in 1954, an Israeli terrorist cell operating in Egypt planted bombs in several buildings, including U.S. diplomatic facilities, and then left behind evidence implicating the Arabs as the culprits. The CIA admits that it hired Iranians in the 1950s to pose as communists and staged bombings in Iran in order to turn the country against its democratically elected prime minister, where, in fact, the United States carried out a coup in 1953, overthrowing the democratically elected government of Iran and reinstalling the Shah, who imposed a tyrannical regime for decades. The Turkish prime minister has admitted the Turkish government carried out the 1955 bombings on a Turkish consulate in Greece and blaming it on Greece in order to incite and justify anti-Greek violence. The British prime minister admitted to his defense secretary he and American President Dwight Eisenhower approved a plan in 1957 carry out attacks in Syria and blame it on the Syrian government as a way to effect regime change. Does that ring any bells with the recent effort of Barack Obama to lob cruise missiles into Syria on the basis of alleged gas attacks by the Syrian government, which were in fact carried out by the rebels under the sponsorship of the Saudi Arabian Prince Bandar, often known as Bandar Bush. Here are 11 through 21. The former Italian prime minister and Italian judge, former head of Italian counterintelligence, admitted that NATO, with the help of the Pentagon and CIA, carried out terror bombings in Italy and other European countries in the 1950s and blamed the communists in order to rally people's support for their governments in Europe and their fight against communism. It goes on and on. We're talking about including the murder of the Turkish prime minister in 1960, bombings in Portugal in 1966, the Piazza Fontana massacre in Italy 1969, terror attacks in Turkey 1971, the Petiano bombing in Italy 1972, shootings in Brescia, Italy, and the bombing of an Italian train 1974, shootings in Istanbul, Turkey 1977, the Atocha massacre in Madrid, Spain, 1977, the abduction and murder of the Italian prime minister, 1978, the bombing of the Bologna railway station in Italy, 1980, shooting and killing of 28 shoppers in Brabant County, Belgium, in 1985. These are all part of Operation Gladio. 22. In 1960, American Senator George Smathers suggested that the United States launch a false attack made on Guantanamo Bay, which would give us an excuse to foment a fight to go into Cuba and overthrow Castro. 23. Official State Department documents show in 1961 the head of the Joint Chiefs and other high-level discussed blowing up a consulate in the Dominican Republic to justify an invasion of that country. 24, as admitted by the U.S. government, recently declassified documents show that in 1962 the Joint Chiefs of staff signed off on a plan to blow up American airplanes and to commit terrorist acts on American soil to blame it on Cubans and justify the invasion of Cuba. This is known as the Operation North Woods, which JFK refused. And, you know, it's just disgusting. 25. In 1963, the U.S. Department of Defense wrote a paper promoting attacks on nations within the Organization of American States, such as Trinidad, Tobago, or Jamaica, to falsely blame them on Cuba. 26, the U.S. Department of Defense suggested covertly paying a person in the Castro government to attack the United States, again to justify invading Cuba. 27, the USA admitted it lied about what really happened in the Tonkin incident in 1964, manufacturing data to make it look like North Vietnamese boats fired on a U.S. ship so as to create a false justification for the Vietnam War. Well, at least that had no serious consequences. Only 50,000 Americans and 2 million Vietnamese died in a fabricated war. 28, a U.S. congressional committee admitted that as part of its COINTELPRO campaign, the FBI had used many provocateurs in the 1950s to the 1970s to carry out violent acts and falsely blame them on political activists. 29, a Turkish general admitted that Turkish forces burned down a mosque on Cyprus in the 1970s to blame it on their enemy. He explained certain acts of sabotage are staged to blame on the enemy to increase public support or resistance. We did this on Cyprus. We even burned down a mosque. Number 30, the German government admitted that in 1978, the German Secret Service detonated a bomb in the outer wall of a prison.
We thank Jim Fetcher, and we'll talk to him again next month. And now our weekly columnist, Phil Ferrugio, whose articles appear on World News Trust, Dandelion Salad, Truth Out, and many others all over the web. Here it is. It's the Empire, stupid.
Okay, keep licking the icing and you'll never eat the cake. You know, Americans love to be diverted. Perhaps it's being bombarded since childhood with massive advertising to the effect of subtle brainwashing. Then factor in the learned desire for the need to gossip, which many of us saw in our families and neighborhoods. Mix this all together and you have a nation of fools who love to spend too much time on whispering about petty scandals while the real scams go virtually unnoticed. It did not matter that Saddam Hussein had no WMDs or chemical or biological weapons, only that he held the rifle upright and acted like the thug that he was. It did not matter that the Wall Street sharks created the subprime con job to the tune of billions in their coffers, only that some undeserving low-income fool was buying a home with a few dollars down, maybe even in your neighborhood. It does not matter that over half of our tax dollars goes to buy overkill weapon systems and $52 million Apache helicopters, or costs us over $1 million annually to keep one soldier in Afghanistan, when some lazy slob online in front of you has food stamps with a new car outside the store and gold chains hanging from his neck. Every 4 years, the super rich who run our empire set the carousel in motion. America becomes obsessed with who is going to run for the presidency. The two-party con job sets the stage for the grand illusion of who to vote for, as Ralph Nader calls it, Tweedledee or Tweedledum. Then the media gets into play. The gossip begins about this candidate and that one. Little by little, they narrow down the field until they have what the suckers need, a real horse race. Meanwhile, the military-industrial empire always gets what it needs to sustain and grow. Less money in the pockets of the serfs and more contracts for the war makers and corporate bandits. Remember this, all you suckers out there who still believe in the stock market and free market and investing, etc. As the late, great Colonel Bob Bowman taught me almost 10 years ago, when wages stay low, the market goes up. When wages go higher, the market goes down, period. Does anyone finally understand that Obama, Bush Jr., Clinton, Bush Sr., Reagan, ad infinitum, always served the empire? Well, they would not be allowed to even run. Do you get it? History, real honest history, reveals how the one guy who got into the office of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and finally had his epiphany was eliminated. Now, all this writer hears from not only the fools who watch Fox News and listen to the right-wing radio, but even the good folks who see through that crap is about gossip and innuendo. When will most of them learn that, sadly, it is not anymore about elections? It is not about Republican versus Democrat finger-pointing and rhetoric. No, it is about empire and the need to pull it back before it totally destroys our very culture as well as our economy. Read the works of Dr. Michael Parenti on this American empire and how it is falling, actually, just as Rome did. Anyone know how to read Chinese? Thank you.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polacek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard.
The U.S. spawned whirlwind of carnage and destruction has wrecked the societies of Iraq, Libya, Syria, Somalia, and Yemen. Yet most Americans feel themselves blameless. The people, the corporate media, and the political system all accept that their government has the right to intervene in the affairs of other nations, and it's always right and moral in its claim. They behave like zombified cogs in an imperial death machine. The United States used the Al Anad Air Base in Yemen as the staging area for drone attacks, which killed some 1,000 people since 2009. Those crimes were committed under the guise of fighting terrorism, but now that same place is the location of karmic justice for the American government and its ally, Saudi Arabia.
United States Special Forces fled from Al Anad before it was overrun by Ansar Allah rebels, also known as the Houthis. It is true that Saudi Arabia bombed Houthi positions and threatens to start a ground invasion with the help of Egypt. Both of these countries are American client states and would not contemplate these actions without having a green light from Washington. The story of Yemen and the shifting international alliances which have brought it to civil war are somewhat complicated. The Houthis ousted the American and Saudi-backed President Hadi, who is now on the run. His predecessor, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was at one time also a Saudi favorite, but is now leading the Houthi advance. While the details can be confusing, one thing is simple.
American imperialism and the war of terror unleashed on that region are ultimately at fault and continue to destroy nation after nation. In its zeal to have and maintain hegemony The United States resorts to brute force and supports others to, who do likewise. The result is dead bodies in Iraq, Libya, Syria, Somalia, and Yemen. But the decisions that lead to these crimes are endemic to American policies. To say that Barack Obama and his Oval Office predecessors made a mess of the Middle East is the very definition of understatement.
Because America's goals are never benevolent, its policies lurch from one awful decision to the next, with human suffering being the only common denominator. Washington used jihadists in Libya to overthrow the Gaddafi government, only to have those same groups kill the American ambassador. Now the U.S. is fighting the same people it supported there just a few years ago. America fights with Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria, but against those same two groups in Iraq. Washington eventually chose to accept the overthrow of Mubarak in Egypt, but now supports the restoration of a dictatorial regime with another leader.
The United States calls the president of Sudan a war criminal, but now fights on the same side in Yemen. When imperialism is the intention, events will never turn out as predicted. The chaos makes sense only when the true nature of American foreign policy is acknowledged. The shifting alliances and seemingly strange bedfellows are part of the longstanding doctrine of manifest destiny. Manifest destiny asserts that the United States has the right to expand its reach anywhere it wants to. The term originally referred to the conquest of North America in the 19th century, but the thinking behind it is still a part of this country's consciousness.
Most Americans know little or nothing about Yemen or Saudi Arabia, but still happily refer to themselves in the first person plural when speaking of their government. They ask, what should we do about Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Libya? While presidents go in and out of office, the people, the corporate media, and the political system all accept that their government has the right to intervene in the affairs of other nations, that it is always right and moral in its claims. The number of Americans who question whether Barack Obama ought to be in the business of ousting the president of Syria or supporting the president of Ukraine are quite slim. The examples of foolish decisions are endless. President Reagan made deals with Iran, but then instigated an Iraqi attack on Iran. Later, the U.S. attacked Iraq in two different wars. The destruction of that country led to a brutal sectarian war and to the rise of the Houthis in Yemen. Yemen is now the epicenter of imperialism run amok. The Saudis fear that the Shia Houthis will be supported by their rival Iran, which the United States now wants to come to terms with in nuclear energy negotiations. Saudi Arabia is therefore on the side of Israel in attempting to scuttle any agreement. There is still no honor among all the thieves.
Whatever policy decisions Washington chooses to make will result in unintended consequences and more violence. Every escalation brings greater danger, and America still has no rival for bringing destruction to millions of people. Violence and chaos have become not just a means at certain ends, but ends in and of themselves. This is just how America rolls.
That's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. Be all you can be. At the end of the day, it is what it is. Have a good day. Bring something to the table, and you will start the revolution today when you make direct eye contact with the next policeman you pass. Our next guest is Susan Lindauer. As a U.S. intelligence asset, Susan Lindauer covered anti-terrorism at the Iraqi embassy in New York from 1996 up to the invasion. And independent sources have confirmed that she gave advance warning about the 9/11 attack. She also started talks for the Lockerbie trial with Libyan diplomats shortly after requesting to testify before Congress about successful elements of pre-war intelligence. Lindauer became one of the first non-Arab Americans arrested on the Patriot Act as an Iraqi agent. She was accused of warning her second cousin, White House Chief of Staff Andrew Carter, Secretary of State Colin Powell, that war with Iraq would have catastrophic consequences. Granted of the Patriot Act, her indictment was loaded with secret charges and secret evidence. She was subjected to 1 year in prison on Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas, without a trial or hearing, and threatened with indefinite detention and forcible drugging to shut her up. After 5 years of indictment without a conviction or guilty plea, the Justice Department dismissed all charges 5 days before President Obama's inauguration. Thank you.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Susan. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. You're on the air.
Hey, everybody. I have amazing news that I hope all of you will really enjoy with me. And I think you'll all appreciate that this is a kind of a victory, I think, for the whole 9/11 truth movement. There is a fantastic director named Roland Joffé, who's very famous. He actually did the movie called The Killing Fields and The Mission. And he has optioned my book, Extreme Prejudice, and he is now starting production. They're actually moving straight to production. They're doing script development right now. And he's going to do a television miniseries. I guess they're calling them limited series television. And it's going to be 6 or 8 episodes. It's going to broadcast in Europe, in London, excuse me, on British television. And he's also negotiating to have it in the European markets as well. We don't know if it'll be seen in the United States. But it will be production will be finished and it will air in 2016. And it's from my perspective, this is a huge victory for all of us, because not only I'm thrilled that they're going to feature my story, but my story is all of our story. It is the story of the 9/11 truth movement. It is the story of the 9/11 advance warrant, the CIA's advance warnings about 9/11, and how that was all melded in with Iraqi pre-war intelligence. And for a lot of people who, you know, for those of us like in this audience, we all know this stuff. We are committed to it. But think about what it means to wake up sheeples who have really been drinking that Kool-Aid pretty hard, and they're pretty addicted to the Kool-Aid. And this is going to be shattering to their whole conscious experience to realize that the United States knew about 9/11 and how the Iraqis offered to have the FBI come into Baghdad, and how they tried to give financial documents that would have shut down terrorism, and all of the things that were going on. And then how it was all covered up by the Bush administration using the Patriot Act. So it wasn't just that they did it and they knew about it, but then they deliberately they used violence against the Constitution to try to hide the truth from the people. So it wasn't just an accident that that ordinary people don't know about this stuff, which I realize none of you are ordinary. I love you guys. you've heard my radio shows so many times. You're like, okay, we've heard this before. But realize that a lot of people, you know, millions of people are still drinking that Kool-Aid. And so this will be, even if they've known it, even if they've used their heads and they've, like I love Richard Gage, and I hope that it would be so cool, and I don't know if this is going to be possible. The production guys are great professionals, and I don't know how, if they'll get into Building 7 or not. You know, I don't know how far they're going to go into it, how far they're going to go into the actual deception, but at the very least, there's going to be an awareness that the American government had a choice, and the American government chose 9/11. And whether they can say the word inside job or not, we say the word inside job, and we know what that means. And I hope they'll go into the, I'm encouraging them to go into the, to at least explore the concept of, you know, of a controlled demolition. I'm trying to get them to do this. And I'd love to have a cameo with Richard Gage. I think that would be so cool if Richard Gage could do a cameo on this thing. But at the very least, there's going to be a discussion about 9/11 and the fact that the United States was not the victim that they've pretended to be. right? And we are that we have pretended to be. That we there was this, you know, let it happen, make it happen. I mean, look, the explosives didn't get into those buildings on their own. They didn't walk into the building. Somebody put them there. Somebody had to study the architectural designs and know exactly where to position these explosives, and that certainly communicates inside job. So you can't really let it happen without making it happen. And that's kind of like, I remember when the argument was first starting, you know, like, which do you believe? It's like, well, you can't have one without the other. And the whole thing about the security trucks, the security cameras capturing video of trucks arriving at the World Trade Center, I'm really pushing them for that. You know, like I said, how far they're going to go, I can't control exactly, but I'm pushing them pretty hard. And then they're going to know about the Patriot Act and the nightmare of Carswell Air Force Base and the nightmare of my incarceration, and also how internet radio people, those of you, I love you guys, was part of turning this, you know, my story was really at the beginning of the end of, you know, the corporate media had control and dominated, you know, right up until the mid-2000s, that mid-decade, the corporate media was so dominant and so overwhelming and powerful. And then, you know, my story kind of happens right as it's tipping and the alternative media is beginning to develop its muscle and its power. And now, of course, we're the dominant force. And the corporate media is, everybody knows what frauds they are. But it's going to be a celebration of internet radio, too. And some of my favorite radio hosts, Michael Herzog, I'm pushing for, I want a character of Michael Herzog from the Great American Awakening. And maybe Jack Blood, too. I hope we're going to get some good, well-deserved love from the camera. Because they certainly, you guys have been really cool. So anyway, I just wanted everybody to know that this is like, it's been a great couple of months for me, though it's still hard. It's still, you know, everything is still pretty rough, but, I'm very excited. So, and the Patriot Act will show the NDAA component, the secret charges, secret evidence. What does this actually mean? Because most people, when they think of the Patriot Act, they think of the surveillance. And I get it. You know, everybody loves Edward Snowden, and he's a hero, and he's exposed this stuff. Actually, William Binney is my personal hero because he exposed it before Edward Snowden exposed it. But I remember that, you know, and William Binney paid the ultimate price. And he is a man who all of us should spend a lot of time, a lot more attention on him. And we should be listening a lot more to what he has to say, because he didn't run. I mean, no. I know everybody. As soon as you start dissing it, as soon as I criticize Edward Snowden, everybody's like, Susan, you can't do that. You know, you cannot. He's sacred. He's a sacred cow. But William Binney didn't run away. Okay, William Binney's my hero. Thomas Drake, my hero, because they stayed and they faced it. And they face the machine, and they face the consequences and the punishments which come down and which are so intense and really scary. And so those are the men that I respect personally. I have a lot more I do respect Edward Snowden. Please, nobody go out and say, Susan Linder says she hates it, doesn't like Edward Snowden. I have tremendous respect for Edward Snowden. What he said is so valuable and necessary. But there's a great deal more to the Patriot Act than the surveillance. And it's very important, and I realize, I understand why everybody cares about it, but it's also the changing dynamics of a court case and how that impacts the rights of a citizen and a defendant in a courtroom where you're facing secret charges. You're not allowed to know what you have been accused of doing. What is the activity that you allegedly committed and you allegedly broke the law? They're not even required to tell you. And what is the evidence to prove that you are the person who did that activity or that that activity even occurred. The government is not required to show any evidence that the crime was ever committed. The prosecutor is literally allowed to stand in front of a jury and a judge and say, Your Honor, take it on faith. It's classified. I'm not allowed to show you anything, but just take my word for it. And you, as a juror, you're not allowed to question whether the government is correct, whether the government has the right to bring the charge. You're pretty much locked into, the way they can write the instructions, the jury instructions, you're pretty much locked into a conviction because otherwise you're not a patriot, or you could be guilty of treason yourself. Because, of course, the government's not going to make up a story without it being true. Where would you – why wouldn't you trust the government, man? So – and then we get into the whole Carswell Air Force Base and the whole nightmare of the government knew that my story was true and knew that my identity was true, and yet they lied to a federal judge. And again, you see, you know, Michael Mukasey hearing Larry Silverstein's insurance claim on the World Trade Center at the same time he's hearing Mike's case, where we're going into court and saying, Your Honor, we knew about 9/11, and which made Larry Silverstein's case insurance fraud. And our attorneys were crossing in the dark, and I don't know if even Roland Jaffe will be that brave to take on Larry Silverstein's insurance attorneys. But we're gonna have a lot of truth in here, and it'll be and I realize, like I said, you guys, you all know the truth. You know, you're all truth tellers. You've read you've studied. You're knowledgeable of this stuff. But let's all be honest. Most people don't. They don't. They believe. They cherish the affinity to the government's goodness, the benevolent, powerful government that has asked them to make these sacrifices, and we have to sacrifice our liberty. This is going to be a big part of this. This is going to be a big part of this, is the sacrifice of liberty to protect the government, which is deceiving us.
Susan, thank you so much for being with us tonight, and congratulations on this miniseries. I look forward to hearing lots more about it. And we'll talk to you again next month.
Thank you.
And now, a message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. From Leonard Peltier in Coleman, Florida, can evil be defeated? John W. Whitehead is a constitutional attorney. As head of the Rutherford Institute, he is actively involved in defending our civil liberties. Being actively involved in legal cases, he experiences firsthand the transformation of law from a shield of the American people into a weapon in the hands of the government. American civil liberty was seriously eroded prior to 9/11 and the rise of the police warfare state. Whitehead, in his book, A Government of Wolves, 2013, and in his just-released Battlefield America, 2015, shows how quickly and thoroughly the police state has taken root. We live in an electronic concentration camp. We are addicted to images on screens that disinform and propagandize us to accept and even welcome the police state activities that have destroyed our autonomy, privacy, and independence.
From Mamaya Abu-Jamal in Frackville, Pennsylvania, the outlook for civil liberties grows bleaker by the day. From the government's embrace of indefinite detention for U.S. citizens and armed surveillance drones flying overhead, to warrantless surveillance of phone, email, and internet communications and prosecutions of government whistleblowers. The homeland is ruled by a police industrial complex, an extension of the American military empire. Everything that our founding fathers warned against is now the new norm. The government has trained its sights on the American people. We have become the enemy. All the while, the American people remain largely oblivious.
from Romaine Chip Fitzgerald in Delano. We're continually abused in the name of protecting us. Ordinary Americans are subject to far worse abuse from government than they ever could be from criminals and terrorists, both of which are boogeymen used to justify the government's terrorism of the citizenry. 4-year-old children are handcuffed by police. 95-year-old citizens with walkers are body slammed with their neck broken by police. War veterans without legs and wheelchair bound are shot and murdered by police. The police always justify their abuse and criminal acts by claiming they felt threatened. What kind of heavily armed police, usually together in gangs, is threatened by a 4-year-old, a 95-year-old, a double amputee? The fact that police get away with this brutality shows their total lack of humanity and the total transformation of the purpose of police. Today, a paranoid police protect not the public, but the police state and themselves from the imaginary threatening public. We pay them to abuse and murder us.
From Larry Hoover in Florence. Did you know that the school security industry is a $4.9 billion annual business that instills in youth acceptance of tyranny and punishments for infractions that are simply the normal behavior of youth? Did you know that in 2006, a Halliburton subsidiary, Dick Cheney's firm, was awarded a $385 million federal contract to build concentration camps in the United States? Did you know that Republicans have privatized the prison system and turned it into a $70 billion per year industry that demands ever more incarceration of citizens in order to drive profits?
From David Rice in Lincoln. Consequently, 2.7 million American children now have at least one parent in prison, often on charges that would not constitute crimes in a civilized country. U.S. prison labor is now the cheapest form of labor available, with prisoners paid between 93 cents and $4.73 per day. Prisoners make office furniture, work in call centers, fabricate body armor, take hotel reservations, work in slaughterhouses, manufacture textiles, shoes, and clothing, process agricultural products like milk and beef, package Starbucks coffee, shrink wrap software for Microsoft, sew lingerie for Victoria's Secret, produce the military's helmets, shirts, pants, tents, bags, canteens, and a variety of other equipment, make circuit boards for IBM, Texas Instruments, and Dell, sew McDonald's uniforms, and perform labor services for Boeing, Motorola, Compaq, Revlon, and Kmart.
From Oscar Lopez Rivera in Terre Haute. Even the mainstream prostitute media has reported the U.S. military drills in South Florida, where military teams working with local police practiced rounding up American citizens for detention. The media has also reported the upcoming military occupations in Texas and Utah. There are protests, but not on the level that a people conscious of the threat to their liberty would mount. It seems clear that these are federal troops practicing control of the population, which is being stripped of the constitutional right to hold government accountable. The pointless lockdown of Boston and its suburbs and the gratuitous house-to-house searches, a martial law exercise clearly prepared prior to the Boston Marathon bombing, used fear created by the bombing, possibly a salt pulse flag operation, to teach the population compliance with and acceptance of martial law. The insouciant American population went along with it. If someone points out how they were manipulated, the fools scream, "Conspiracy theorist!"
From Gary Tyler in Angola. The official explanation of the military exercises practicing population control in South Florida, Texas, and Utah is that the military is practicing for overseas actions. Why then are local police involved? More likely, we are witnessing drills described in the U.S. Army's 2010 publication, Internment and Resettlement Operations. It is now routine for police to amuse themselves by carrying out strip searches and vaginal searches of women. Police go out of their way to provoke resistance so they can beat, taser, and murder. If they can't provoke it, they beat, taser, and murder anyway and claim their victim resisted arrest or threatened them. Have you noticed how the police find everyone threatening? Whitehead shows that the educational system, entertainment, and television serve to indoctrinate and teach compliance. Television can do more than form public opinion. It is used to alter the worldview of the population. Our cars, household appliances, and smart homes are becoming devices designed to spy on us and report noncompliance. A society is being created in which there can be no autonomy and no freedom.
And this, Justin, from Debbie Sims Africa in Cambridge Springs, Pennsylvania. The technology that permits the electronic concentration camp is produced by thoughtless people who have no concern for liberty. How, Whitehead asks, do we maintain our humanity in the face of technologies designed to dehumanize us? America now has preemptive prosecution. Whitehead reports that 95% of those convicted of terrorism between 2001 and 2010 were prosecuted not for deeds, but for beliefs, ideology, or religious affiliations. The fusion of machines with humans to which transhumanists are committed will destroy human sensibility, memory, and morality, and probably humans themselves. Corporate America is in it for the money. Whitehead tells us, with every smartphone we buy, every GPS device we install, and every Twitter, Facebook, and Google account we open, we're helping corporate America build a dossier for its government counterparts on who we know, what we think, how we spend our money, and how we spend our time. Whitehead quotes Bill Joy, a co-founder of Sun Microsystems. I think it is no exaggeration to say we're on the cusp of the further perfection of evil. Jim Edwards says, we humans are now data bits.
And from David Gilbert in Auburn, New York, in the penultimate chapter, Whitehead tells us what we can do. Whitehead says that armed revolt is not an option. He believes that the tens of millions, perhaps 100 million Americans who have pistols, rifles and shotguns are not only unorganized, but outgunned. The 21st century has been used to militarize state and local police forces and to brutalize their attitude toward the American public. Even police in small towns now have helicopters, armed personnel carriers, tanks, machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, drones, night vision, heat sensors, sensors that can see through the walls of houses and into cars. If this is not enough, in comes the National Guard or federal troops, Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, or simply the release of germs. Washington can deal with its citizens the same way it dealt with the indigenous people we call Indians. Washington has retained in its hands live smallpox, a deadly killer, and there now have been several generations of Americans who have not had smallpox vaccination because the disease was eliminated by vaccination. All the government has to do is to release smallpox on resistant populations, and of course, the government has numerous other such means. How did it come to this?
From Jeremy Hammond in Manchester, Kentucky. In my opinion, Americans are distracted by sex, entertainment, the difficulty of providing for themselves and for families. They are locked into the disinformation that sustains the American matrix, blinded by their patriotism and the 4th of July speeches and by their indoctrination that Americans are exceptional and indispensable. And, of course, by their ignorance and arrogance. Americans simply have no clue. The purpose of the evil that masquerades as a government in Washington is to prevent those few Americans who do have a clue from informing the rest of the population. Whistleblowers are arrested and falsely prosecuted and imprisoned. Journalists have been intimidated into silence. Now to Whitehead's answer to what we can do. He says we can mount militant, nonviolent resistance. This worked for Christians in the decomposing Roman Empire. It worked for Mahatma Gandhi in India against the British colonialists. It was working for Martin Luther King in America before he was assassinated, most likely by the FBI. Whitehead says that the mass of the citizenry cannot be assassinated if citizens simply stop cooperating by listening to the lies on TV, by purchasing the devices used to control them, by amusing themselves in front of propaganda screens, by learning again how to think, how to be human, how to be moral. The American police state can be defeated. It worked in the past, and possibly it can work again. If not, Washington will remain the home of Sauron, a threat to every American citizen and to the entire world.
A message in a Boone's Farm bottle, some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown, at the end of the empire. Duluth is a microbrewery of what is going on everywhere, where the people fight to have some sort of say and leave it to the outlaws to come up with something, leave it to the guys in the jails and carrying skateboards, leaning up against a light pole at 2 a.m. to come up with something. It's the home of Piker McNugget, Carol Kopecky, Frosty Pine, Winnie Bloodfeather, some 23 Toivonens, Diamond Griffin and Penny Jones, families from Minneapolis and St. Paul and St. Peter and Mankato and Des Moines, thundering up Interstate 35, hit full throttle on Friday afternoon, accelerating past Hinckley and Sandstone, past Pine City, Barnum, Cloquet, to get away, to let their hair down, to get bugs and branches in their hair. You turn your phone to vibrator, heave it into the ditch, grenade style, change your radio from WCCO to the Moose. Up and up and around and over the hill, and there it is, the view, Lake Superior, the big lake. And there is the lift bridge in Morgan Park and New Page Paper Plant. The bridges to Superior, Wisconsin, the bay, the big boats. Turn right to Canal Park for the tourists. Turn left, uphill, for those who have already decided to stay. Duluth is baked burritos and apricot wheat beer and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings. Like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops, and it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling, brawls, Bigfoot, and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the gold. We continue our story. We're going to meet Lazarus Luciano, a local entrepreneur, Sonny Castillo, just now getting released from the prison at Moose Lake. And if there is time, we will meet Diamond Griffin on her birthday, her death day, that is.
The line clogged at the door. Some group had stopped to look at the glass display case on the wall with the photos of the crew members from the Edmund Fitzgerald. Hey! The owner, Lazarus Luciano, raised his hand and hollered from behind the glass case display counter. Papa! His daughter Bernadette, right next to him, stopped him with her big brown eyes and her sharp purple fingernails into his arm. He lowered his voice. Please, do be so kind. He projected through the crowd, waiting to pay their bill all the way to the door. Lazarus Luciano, a thin, dark-haired man, stood as tall as the cash register perched on the glass display case, stretched across the front entryway of the general store. Inside the case sat neat rows of cannoli Napoleon, regular cannoli, babas, rum baba, eclair, zeppole, chocolate ganache. It was by now the middle of the morning rush. Some folks stopped for the brioche and cappuccino, others for the live music with the violin and piano on the raised stage 10 feet from the front counter. Some others for bait, worms, Italian minnows, leeches, or sporting goods, guns, fishing poles, bear traps. Some came for knitting supplies, art supplies, or to have holes put in their new bowling ball. Some purchased gas outside at the two pumps. Others crowded inside the general store in their good clothes to attend the daily church services held down below, around and around the circular staircase to the catacombs. Papa! A black-haired daughter lifted the black telephone into the air. For you! She held the phone in the air like it had germs until he took it. Lazarus tried to reach around to the register, the Espresso, the daily newspaper staff, while talking on the phone and also with his customers, who by now were a mob holding up cards and money, clamoring for double this, grappa, double that. Lazarus was ensconced in a battle with the city and state and many others, trying to keep the new live bait superstore from coming to town. "It would be the end of me," he cried to anyone who had listened through the sale of leeches, worms, though the sale of leeches, worms, and minnows was only a small percentage of his intake. "I will call you back." Lazarus Luciano spoke into the black telephone. He put out his hand. His daughter placed her pink and green telephone into it. "Be right back." Lazarus smiled. His daughter did not smile. With stone face, she turned back to the counter to face the people. Like Mexicans storming the Alamo, having to trip over the body of Davy Crockett, they were forced to find their way around by way of sharp edges dug into their ribs, around the lighted glass case containing a Bible set upside down. It had been put in upside down by the cabinet maker in a hurry to please Lazarus as he fought to open the general store before the new plastic worms appeared in Gander Mountain. Lazarus had declared it miraculous by raising his hands and saying so, and went on to the next thing, and the next, and the next. Lazarus hurried around the counter, excused himself half a dozen times, smiled quickly at his wife, trapped by herself this morning in the simulated stream, giving kayaking lessons to Dubuque Methodists who were more interested in the photos of dead bear and deer on the log cabin walls mixed in with the First Communion photos of the Luciano children and the large family portrait with the lift bridge and bay in the background. He slid around and around on the circular railing all the way to the bottom. "But how can that be?" He held the cell phone to his ear and walked down to the narrow, low, dark, damp concrete hallway with the brick side, kicking his Botticelli through the standing water. "Voices?" he asked. "How can they hear a voices? There's no a voices. Jesus!" Lazarus stalked back and forth like a Christian waiting to meet the lions, not totally sure of himself, hearing the roar of the crowd above at the previous man's fate. "Someone's helping them? Who? How? Why?" Sonny Castillo stood at her window looking through the trees down on the lake. Some leaves hung on. A V wave on the water showed there must be a beaver or something out there swimming. There, a canoe with a nice couple on board. Over on the highway, the McDonald's morning crowd had gathered, and on the Lakeshore Drive, that one house with a sort of A-frame and the big wood front porch that could be a wraparound if someone were able to go look. They had another crowd around the grill. Must be a game on TV or somewhere. "Hey, there goes a goose bee like they're in a hurry or missed the bus. Most everyone else is 2 months gone by now. These guys are late for the party in Cancun." Sonny smiled at her own quiet joke. Sonny Castillo stood with her toes just even with the threshold. She felt the breeze coming off the lake on her face and the cold cement through the thin shoes they gave her. She filled the doorway, carrying the black duffel, the one they'd given her because it was just sitting beyond the desk on the floor. Otherwise, she would have to leave with her letters and a few clothes and a Super One sack. She felt someone right behind her, as if to say, "You can't come back here." "You ready?" said the woman. "Nope," said Sonny, facing straight ahead. Sonny stood tall, head and shoulders above the guard, her stunning long black hair falling back over her shoulders in the brown jacket. The brown pants and white tennis shoes made her look like a UPS driver. The winding front drive meandered from the street, carrying through trees up the hill to the front door, where someone might already be waiting in a car to take you home. "Fall, the best time of the year," said the black guard with the short hair, olive down jacket and brown boots, still standing right behind Sonny. the top of her head, even with Sonny's shoulders. That's what my Sonny almost turned around to face the guard to talk and smile, but she stopped. Faced front again and stuck out her foot. "See ya," said the guard. Sonny kept going along the sidewalk, somehow putting distance between herself and the giant maroon brick wall. She turned to look over her right shoulder at her room to see the bars from this side. Instead, her eyes stopped her head from turning by noticing the little park with the circle of trees and a circle of benches inside the trees where visitors waited and where some of the staff ate lunch in the summer. She hated it. She had a name for it. Dante's Park. She smelled the meat on the grill and leaves burning. She felt the sidewalk through the thin shoes. She felt the sidewalk through the thin shoes.
And that's the news from Duluth, where all the police and soldiers are thugs. All the Democrats and journalists are cowards. And all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We're allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There's no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see. No JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetimes. No destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police. No evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we can even look at it. We're not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. And that's the end of another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week and every week right here.